Blog Talk Radio.
Yoga is much more than physical stretches on a yoga mat that we're so familiar with, or even more than just sitting and meditating. It helps to enhance all types of healing, physical, emotional, and even spiritual healing, and to cultivate your inner shine. So today we'll be talking about that with our guest. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Healthy Baby Boomers Network Blog Talk Radio Show. I'm your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, licensed mental health counselor, healing through love relationship healer, somatic body psychotherapist, and health and wellness coach, helping men and women heal their bodies and their relationships through love. Author of the Love Me, Touch Me, Heal Me book series, the romantic novel Love in the Blizzard of Life, and creator of the powerful Healing Through Love lessons. This show is all about living your dreams, fulfilling your life purpose, and creating and sustaining love and health and total well-being for the rest of your life, no matter what age you are right now. In every episode, I speak with vibrant, exciting, and positive men and women who keep proving that life can, and often does, get better and better as we reach our 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and beyond. So today, I'm speaking with Cindy Warren. She's a certified yoga meditation teacher by passion, attorney by trade, different combination, and author of Radiate, Using the Practice to Cultivate Inner Shine. She was drawn to yoga for the physical practice, but very soon she discovered that yoga helped her to deal with life challenges more effectively. And I look forward to finding out how yoga has helped you. So welcome, Cindy Warren.
Thank you so much, Dr. Goodstone. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I would love to hear about your background and training, because you said you're an attorney, and, you know, how does that fit? You know, you're following the law. That's really in this world, and yoga's a little more out of this world. So please tell us about your background, education, training, and what led to getting involved with yoga and then writing about it, becoming a teacher and then writing about it.
Absolutely. It'd be my pleasure. So I became a lawyer in the 90s, and all through my years in academia, I studied hard. I always had an interest in physical fitness, so I exercised a lot to sort of help with the stress and that sort of thing. But by nature, I've always been sort of a type A go, go, go personality. I first was introduced to yoga in the early 2000s because I kept hearing about what a great workout it is. And it is. But I quickly discovered that there's so much more going on there. So I would leave, you know, a sweaty power yoga practice and notice that I felt internal shifts that I really couldn't explain by just the physical practice, even though the physical practice itself is and can be very powerful. So I got curious, and I happened to find some wonderful teachers early in my journey who studied some philosophy with me. I became interested in the more contemplative, introspective aspects of the yoga practice, and really just became a very committed student for well over a decade. And I would say through the yoga practice, I became softer. It didn't change me. I was always myself, but in so many ways, I felt like I became a better version of myself, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, after about 11 or 12 years of practice, I decided to become a teacher. And after teaching for several years, it really dawned on me that so many modern practitioners and even some teachers really don't have a solid foundation in the philosophical underpinnings of yoga, which is an ancient practice dating 5,000 years, give or take. And so I wanted to write a book. It's just a way to educate the modern yogi or even just the yoga curious about what is this big thing called yoga that we see so many representations of in the media and we hear a lot of buzz about, but we're maybe not getting the whole depth of it.
Okay, so what was it about the practice of yoga that appealed to you, at least to start?
To start, it was probably the most powerful thing about the physical practice for me was the marrying of breath and movement. So, you know, I've been a runner for many years. If I go on a run, I'm not really necessarily so in tune to what's happening inside myself. I tend to enjoy the scenery, get lost in thought, think of to-do lists. And yoga was a practice that really, or it is a practice, I should say, that really brings the practitioner squarely to the present moment. So there's an intense focus on what is happening in the body and in the and with the breath from moment to moment. And that was really different than any other physical practice I've explored. And something about tethering yourself to the present moment tends to shift the mind, the heart, the intellect, the spirit. Something happens when you're not racing here or there or thinking about the past or worrying about the future. And yoga is really the only physical practice I've found in my 45 plus years on earth that does that, that brings you right into the now.
And did you have any physical issues that brought you into yoga?
I really didn't. No, I was a healthy, like 30-year-old when I first started practicing yoga. I think there are many benefits of the physical practice, and as you alluded to earlier, it has many, many healing properties. I have a lot of students who come to yoga with physical ailments, and I've seen it help not just physical ailments but emotional ailments as well. But for me, at the time, I was just a young woman looking to get a good sweat.
and we were talking right before we started about tech neck, and I've certainly had that. I sit at the computer much more than I should, you know, and I taught yoga so many years ago at the college. I taught for 25 years, so I really know yoga, and yet, boy, it's so easy to get away from it and to just sit for hours at a time bent over. And people do it everywhere. So just talk about that, what you've seen. I love the term tech neck.
Yeah, and the tech neck is a relatively recent phenomenon. I don't think it was happening to this degree even, 17 years ago when I started practicing yoga. It has become a much more technologically dependent society where everyone's on their iPhones or their computer or in the car, and there's almost a hunching that has become the normal stance of most Westerners. And yoga really does have a tremendously healing impact on that, in that it lengthens the spine and teaches you to stand, sit, and move with proper alignment. So many of the chronic pain issues that exist, for example, just in America today, are a result of our increasingly sedentary lifestyle. Even for, I was sort of cut from the cloth of I would work out for an hour a day, and then the rest of the day I'd be hunched over law books or my computer or whatever it was. And I think most Americans live largely in a sedentary way, and yoga really does keep the entire body supple by creating the healthy alignment of the spine. So I think that's one of the most healing benefits of yoga, particularly as we get into middle age and beyond.
Right, and that's when it starts to get harder to do it, and you might stop, and that's just when you need it the most.
That's exactly
because
right.
Because it can prevent so much by getting the circulation moving throughout your body, not to mention clearing up your emotional attitude and your feelings. But I want to ask you something before I forget. Did you leave the practice of law, or do you still practice law?
I still practice law in a way. I'm not with a law firm anymore. I was a litigator for many years, and now I have my own consulting business where I provide human resources consulting. My field is employment law. So I still have my day law-ish job, although it's not technically practicing law. So it does come with a lot of stress and a lot of typing and a lot of, hunching over. And I find yoga very helpful in both the physical and the beyond the physical arenas.
Okay, so now what does the name of your book mean? I mean, it sounds like radiate, but when you spell it, it's R-A-D-I-8.
Exactly. So it's the title of the book is a nod to the traditional eight-limbed or eight-part path of yoga philosophy. So most people in America and just in the West in general know yoga as moving on your yoga mat, downward facing dog, etc. That is only one of eight limbs. So most modern yogis are literally only practicing one-eighth of yoga when they think they're engaged in the practice of yoga. There are seven other limbs that are just as important. Asana.
They call that the yoga asanas, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And that's literally the third limb that's laid out in the ancient and probably best known tome, if you will, on the yoga philosophy called the Yoga Sutras. So the Yoga Sutras was the first writing to lay out this eight-part path that forms the basis for modern yoga.
So can you tell us what these paths are?
Absolutely. The first of the eight limbs is called yamas, Y-A-M-A-S. And these are ethical considerations. There are five ethical guidelines that pertain to how we move in the world. The second limb is called the niyamas, N-I-Y-A-M-A. And the niyamas are an additional set of five guidelines that pertain to our relationship with ourself. The third limb is asana, the physical practice. Next is called pranayama, which is breath work or breath control. So many times within the context of a group yoga class, the teacher will be cueing pranayama as you link breath to movement. But pranayama is also a limb unto itself, and one could just sit, you know, take a 30-second break in the middle of the workday and engage in a little breath work that would really shift their energy and shift their nervous system, to be more precise. The next limb is called pratyahara, which literally translates from the Sanskrit as sensory withdrawal. And this is when the practitioner takes him or herself away from the external world and shuts out external stimulation and goes inside. So you might picture this as yogi walking into a cave and staying in the cave for some amount of time back in the day. It obviously plays out a little differently in our modern world, but it's still a quite important limb. After that,
I think we're back in the day. Just a moment, because there are some people still going to some caves in the Himalayas and different places for that experience.
You're absolutely right.
I did that for a while.
That's amazing. And we just, you know, in for most modern practitioners, especially in the West, that's not so accessible. But you're absolutely right. The next limb is called dharana, which means concentration, literally training your mind on one point of focus and keeping it there. So that's the beginning stage of meditation. It's also the polar opposite of the multitasking that we see so much in our modern tech age. The seventh limb, it's very interesting. The seventh limb is called dhyana. That means meditation. And the entire practice of meditation is a tremendously important part of this big practice called yoga. So an entire limb is devoted to that. And then the final limb is called samadhi, which translates as enlightenment. There is some debate among yoga teachers as to what this means, whether it is even attainable. I describe it in the book as something that we can get a little glimpse of throughout our lives if we work on spiritual and contemplative practice. And I think of it as sensing into kind of a universal connection. So feeling mm-hmm. that you're part of the same thing that everyone else is part of. That might be just a little accessible glimpse of samadhi.
Yeah, I had an experience of that at the Shivananda Ashram in Paradise Island. Was a long time ago, 1976. And Ravi Shankar was playing the sitar, and I had been meditating and eating the vegetarian food, and I just suddenly had an experience of what it's like to be a road and be a car and be a tree, and I was sending
wow.
love to everybody. You know, it was like, wow, I don't know where it came from, but that was the experience. But that, it just can't last in the real world. You know,
right, but even to get
so
a glimpse
intense.
Of it and to remember it all these years later, how special.
Well, that's what happens. People do have these momentary experiences.
Right.
And it is good to remember it or to come back to it. But in living in the world, you know, it's pretty hard. You're living your everyday life.
Exactly.
So
very true.
My next question is, why do you think most people who practice yoga don't know about these eight limbs and the value of it?
Part of it, I think, is time constraint. So we've whittled yoga down in most studios to a 60-minute practice that serves as workout as well as work in and for some relaxation. It's a lot to get in 60 minutes, and teaching the physical practice of yoga requires extensive study. So to then add the philosophy onto it, I think, is more than a lot of yoga teachers undertake. It's just more study, more work. It's not really required to be a certified yoga teacher. So I think the pace of society has something to do with it. I also think media depictions go to, you know, the lowest common denominator, which is a beautiful body and an elegant posture. And people see it and can relate to it or not, can admire it or not, and end up making the assumption that, oh, that is yoga.
Oh, interesting that you said that you can get certified really knowing the asanas rather than knowing the whole practice of yoga. But when it started out, when they first came here from India to teach us about this, you didn't get certified so easily. There were people living at the yoga ashram, doing service, meditating daily, you know, cooking and doing everything in that place and following all the... So
that's exactly right. It has changed. And I think some of it is due to the commercialization of yoga. Teacher trainings tend to be big money makers for yoga studios. So yoga studios churn out teachers after, you know, to be a certified yoga teacher with Yoga Alliance, you only need 200 hours, which is just not a lot to learn really any of the limbs, let alone all eight of them.
Well, I'm finding that with everything, with fitness training, you know, people are getting certified without having the whole broad background that they need. So now I'd like to ask some questions. Like, you talk about yamas, they are external restraints, but you also said they were ethical considerations. So please explain that and maybe give some examples.
Sure, absolutely. So the primary ethical guideline of all of yoga philosophy is called ahimsa, which means nonviolence or non-harming. So we can think of Gandhi as sort of the exemplar of living ahimsa. It is a way of relating to the world around you, thinking about how your actions, your deeds, your words, even your thoughts affect those around you, the world around you. And so that's sort of the pinnacle of the ethical guidelines. For example, if other such guidelines come into conflict with ahimsa, I like to think of it as ahimsa always wins. So another one of the yamas is is satya, which means truth. Ahimsa is always the tiebreaker. Satya means truth, and it's more than simply go through life not lying, you know, tell the truth, but it's also a deeper look at what is your real truth. For example, if you're passionate about animal welfare, that's really important to you. You know, are you living in alignment with that principle, living your truth that way?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you go out and eat factory farmed chicken or what have you? So that would be an example. Now, if ahimsa and satya were somehow in conflict, like someone asked, for example, do these jeans make my butt look fat? Satya might say, if they do, tell the truth. Ahimsa would say, no, non-harming first. We don't go around gratuitously insulting, even if we're asked to. So that's sort of a silly example of where a couple might come into conflict.
Well, it sounds like politeness and gracefulness in the way that you approach other people, which so many people were trained in generations past.
That's
right.
They didn't
just come out and blurt the truth and be, you know, insulting to somebody.
Right.
How interesting. And it's fun to hear this from your perspective, to get new perspective on yoga.
Great. One of the most interesting things to me about this whole, you know, endeavor of yoga study and yoga practice and thinking and teaching and writing about yoga is the yogis, the original yogis in India, did so much introspection and study of the human condition that all that they taught is, in some ways, it seems more relevant today to our modern world than it even would have been to them. And modern science and research into meditation, breath work, asana practice really just proves the scientific truth of what the yogis were doing in India thousands of years ago.
Absolutely.
So I really love the modern translation of the practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, modern medicine and modern research is really catching up after all this time.
Exactly.
And it's a slow process.
They haven't really caught up yet. Right.
So now I have another question related to that. You talk about the niyamas as internal restraints. So this is not about the effect on other people and the outer world. So talk about that. What is that?
Yoga philosophy starts with the premise, and I think this is mirrored in most forms of modern psychology, that your relationship with yourself really sets the groundwork for how you move through life. So tending to that inner relationship, which is something that most people, you know, we don't learn how to relate to ourselves necessarily in school. It's something that the yogis really focused on. So one of the niyamas, for example, is called svadhyaya, which translates as self-study. So there's a big focus on first increasing your own self-awareness. So understanding your triggers, your emotional reactions, and then from that place of understanding, gaining tools to make more skillful choice. So you mentioned a moment ago, you know, there's a gentleness, a lightness in how you move through the world. According to yoga principles, can you apply that to your relationship with yourself as well? And many of us, I think, have very critical relationships with ourselves. I know, especially in my teens and 20s, I really beat myself up in my own head. And yoga and its practices and the increased self-awareness it helped me develop really helped heal me of the internal damage I was doing to myself simply by the way I was talking to myself.
And I have interviewed several really leading yoga teachers, not necessarily American, from other countries. And one of them spent I don't remember how much time, but a few months in the Himalayas in a cave. And he managed to get annoyed by people who, there were people that came to the cave, people, there are people living up there that came to the cave, and he got bothered by that, and he had to really process it in his meditation. And there's like a bug on him. So even going to a cave to meditate, you don't get away from yourself and your own reaction.
Right.
And
right.
That
but you
interesting that, to hear.
That is so fascinating. But what you do get when you start slowing down, getting quiet, paying attention, it's just that awareness. Oh boy, I'm annoyed at this. Can I not get carried away by the annoyance? Just notice it and make a better choice.
Mm-hmm. And the other piece that one of the yogis talked about was that the way we do yoga and meditate, he was mostly talking about meditation. The way we do meditation is you go sit in a room and meditate for a half hour, and then you go out in the world and you're honking your horn and you're angry and all that other stuff.
Right.
So he was saying
right.
to do that meditation in every moment. And you did talk
exactly.
about that at the beginning. About the power of being present.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I sometimes joke about that in my class too. You know, someone might nail a complex, quote, advanced yoga posture, and then go out into the world and, as you said, honk their horn or cut someone off, and are they really practicing yoga? And I think the answer is no. You just had
mm-hmm.
some postural prowess, but you weren't being a yogi.
Right, and that's why it's such an ongoing process. It can't happen quickly. We're too
exactly.
human. We have too many emotions and thoughts and influences all around us.
And to me, that's the fun of it. You're never done with your personal or spiritual journey. Well, I'll speak for myself. I'm not yet. And I hope I never am because, yeah, it's a process of learning and forgetting and relearning and repracticing, and that's what makes it interesting, I think.
And so I have another question. Do you think that maybe the way yoga has been watered down and made into a physical process, do you think it has anything to do with people being afraid of it being some kind of religion that they don't want to get into?
I do think that's part of it. And I try and debunk that a little bit in the book. I view yoga as just secular humanitarian kind of philosophy of how to live your life. In my mind, it coexists with any religion and also just as well with no religion at all. It just simply is not a religion
mm-hmm.
the way I study and practice yoga.
And then another question is, can someone still practice yoga if they don't attend a yoga class?
Absolutely. Seven other limbs available to you. You could just say, I just want to do the breath work, or I just want to meditate, or I just want to take a break from, you know, modern technology and let that be my yoga for the day or the week. There are countless ways to practice yoga, and most of them don't have anything to do with a yoga mat.
Yeah, and I'm realizing as I'm talking to you how valuable this can be for someone's life, because we never know what's coming. Someone can die. I mean, all those disasters, you lose your home
yeah.
in a fire or a hurricane. And if you have these inner resources and this perspective on what it is to be alive, it can make a huge difference in your coping.
I think that is such an important point, that we don't wait until things go off the wire to develop a yoga practice or a meditation practice or some, you know, internal tools of coping with life. We do the practice in the good times so that we're ready when the bad times hit, and they will. It's simply the nature of the world.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, greatest gift for you of your yoga practice?
It is hard to pick just one, but I will try. As I alluded to earlier, I think by nature I am a very reactive kind of person, short-tempered, a little impatient, and in some ways that has served me well with you know, setting academic and professional goals for myself and meeting them, but in interpersonal relationships, or even more importantly, my own relationship with myself, it's not served me so well. And I think yoga has given me tools to slow down, to create space between what happens in my life and how I respond to it. And I don't always get it right, but boy, I am so much better now than I was 20 years ago. And I definitely see a trajectory of growth in my own life.
Wow, that's really beautiful. All right, so tell us about this book, your book. You know, who is it for and how can people get it?
Wonderful. So the book is called Radiate, spelled R-A-D-I and the number 8. It's on Amazon if you type in Radiate Yoga or my name, Cindy Warren. And it's also on my website, which is www.yoga8book. And again, the number 8, yoga8book.com. And the book is really for anyone who either practices yoga, is considering or already does teach yoga, or just wants to know what is all the buzz about this yoga thing. So I really wrote it for a wide-ranging audience in very accessible terms with easy, daily, quick practices people can try to just start to incorporate some of the principles into their daily lives.
Yes, your book really is valuable for people in our culture. We have no patience. We want the answers right away. And if you go into some of these old ancient yoga books, you're going to be reading words and words and, you know, and not understand it well. So I can see how you have simplified the whole process for us. So that's great.
Thank you so much. So, that was definitely my goal.
So Cindy Warren, thank you so much for being on my show today. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Such a pleasure, Dr. Goodstone. Thanks so much.
To those of you listening, I'm your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, saying goodbye for now. Please visit my website, drericagoodstone.com, and you can get a complimentary Love Mastery Secrets session. You just have to apply for it or send me an email requesting it. I look forward to speaking to you again soon.